Good day and welcome to the Trust for America's Health Ready or Not 2011 conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'll turn the conference over to Dr. Jeff Levy. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, operator. Good morning. My name is Jeff Levy, and I'm Executive Director of the Trust for America's Health. Thank you for joining us today for the release of our annual report, Ready or Not, Protecting the Public's Health from Diseases, Disasters, and Bioterrorism. This report is being released by Trust for America's Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. A copy of the full report, including state-specific information, is on our website at www.healthyamericans.org. I'm honored to be joined today by Dr. Mel Cohn, who is the State Health Officer and Public Health Director at the Oregon Health Authority. I'll start the call with an overview of key findings from the report, then Dr. Cohn will provide comments from the state's perspective. I'll close with some recommendations from the report, and then we'll open up the call for questions. In the Ready or Not report, we've looked at how well the nation's public health system is prepared to respond to disease outbreaks, natural disasters, or acts of bioterrorism. We feel it is important to conduct this report each year because we believe that the public deserves to know how prepared their states and communities are to respond to public health emergencies. For the past 9 years, we've documented how preparedness has been on an upward trajectory. While there are serious ongoing gaps, the progress in upgrading the system since the September 11 and anthrax tragedies 10 years ago has been dramatic. But the economic crisis has changed the story. Now we're seeing a decade's worth of progress eroding in front of our eyes. Some of the most elementary capabilities, including the ability to identify and contain outbreaks, provide vaccines and medications during emergencies, and treat people during mass traumas, are experiencing cuts in every state across the country. In past years, we've provided an assessment of every state based on a series of indicators. This year, we instead are focusing on projections into the future. We looked at the impact that budget cuts have had so far, in combination with the proposed upcoming budget cuts and likely funding scenarios, and have found that a number of programs that help detect and respond to bioterrorism and other health emergencies are at risk for major cuts or elimination. As a nation, we've invested in improving preparedness for health emergencies, ranging from a pandemic flu to natural disasters to a bioterrorism event. 10 years later, we were seeing improvements in rapid detection of threats, plans, and strategies for how to contain the spread of new diseases and health threats, and the ability to more rapidly provide vaccines and antiviral medications to the public in case of emergencies. But the recent cuts to preparedness funds at the federal, state, and local levels means we're chipping away at these gains. In the past year, 40 states and Washington, D.C. cut state public health funds, with 29 of those states and D.C. cutting their budgets for a second year in a row and 15 states cutting their public health budgets for 3 years in a row. Federal funds for state and local preparedness declined by 38% from fiscal years 2005 to 2012 when you adjust for inflation. The Great Recession is taking its toll on emergency health preparedness. Major gains in preparedness since 9/11 and anthrax are in real jeopardy due to severe budget cuts at the federal, state, and local level. While we don't know precisely how the federal government will implement some of these budget cuts, we do know from our analysis of budget cuts, budget documents, and other sources that the fiscal 12 cuts and the potential fiscal 13 sequestration will impact every state in the nation in one way or another. Among the investments at risk include 51 of the 72 cities that are currently part of the city's readiness initiative are at risk for elimination from the program. This initiative supports the ability to rapidly distribute and administer vaccines and medications during emergencies and are at risk for elimination. All 10 state labs with level 1 chemicals testing status are at risk for losing top-level capabilities, which could leave the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention with the only public health lab in the country with full ability to test for chemical terrorism and accidents. 24 states are at risk for losing the support of career epidemiology field officers, CDC experts who supplement state and local gaps to rapidly prevent and respond to outbreaks and disasters, such as during the H1N1 flu pandemic and responding to the health impact of the Gulf oil spill in 2010. And finally, the ability for CDC to mount a comprehensive response to nuclear, radiologic, and chemical threats, as well as natural disasters, is at risk due to potential budget cuts at the National Center for Environmental Health. All 50 states and Washington, D.C. would lose the support CDC provides during these emergencies. Now, these are specific programmatic cuts. We don't know which ones the administration will choose to implement in the course of implementing the fiscal 12 budget that Congress just passed, and we don't know which of these might ultimately be implemented if we see sequestration in fiscal 13, as now seems to be on the horizon with the failure of the supercommittee to arrive at a new budget deal. But these are the kinds of capabilities that are at risk in the current budgetary climate. That said, our report also identifies several major vulnerabilities in U.S. preparedness that already existed even before additional budget cuts. Now, we note in this report the tremendous progress that has been made over the last 10 years, but it is far from complete. And among the gaps that we identify as continuing include the ability to maintain basic emergency capabilities. Instead, we often have a knee-jerk band-aid approach to responding to emergencies after they happen instead of being prepared for when they happen. So a perfect example of the budget situation today is that the budget cuts until now have been tempered, the budget cuts in the base have been tempered to some degree by investments made in response to the H1N1 pandemic flu. Those resources have gone away, and so we're actually just beginning to see the impact of the cuts. But that's a symbol of the kind of the way that we respond to emergencies. We respond after the fact when an emergency has arisen. If we don't maintain our core capacity, that's going to be a poor investment in the future. We also lack a coordinated biosurveillance system, which hampers our ability to detect and track bioterrorism attacks or disease outbreaks quickly. We have gaps in researching, developing, and manufacturing vaccines and antiviral medications, and the budget that the President is about to sign does not address that problem at all in terms of greater investments. We have gaps in the ability to provide care for an influx of patients during mass trauma events, and the budget the President is about to sign cuts the hospital preparedness program, which is our principal program for trying to address that. And we have gaps in the way we help communities cope with and recover from emergencies. But that's the overview. I'm now going to turn the call over to Dr. Mel Cohn, who's the State Health Officer and Public Health Director of the Oregon Health Authority, who can give you an idea of what the implications of these cuts have meant on the ground. Mel?
Thank you, Jeff. Good morning, everybody. You know, Americans expect the public health system to have the capability to confidently protect their health during emergencies. This is really not an optional service. It's not something we can just decide we can't afford right now because it's got life and death consequences. Really, our health security is dependent on this funding from the federal government. Our whole preparedness and response program is funded through this mechanism, and Oregon is not unique in that regard. States across the U.S. are facing the same challenges. These grant dollars support a variety of capabilities every day in our public health activities at the state and local level, including key disease surveillance, our laboratory capacity, epidemiology capacity, communications, and our emergency operations capabilities. And I want to give you just a few examples from Oregon of some of the everyday ways we have used this that I hope will resonate with you. So, for example, in 2009, we had a detection of E. coli in the water in Portland. Portland is our largest city here in Oregon, and this detection occurred after hours, and so the response capability that our preparedness system paid for was key in this whole activity. Our city and county health officials worked together to ensure that all of our residents had access to safe drinking water. In 2011, this year, earlier this year, we had an outbreak of E. coli in strawberries. There were five Oregon counties that were affected, and really there were two things that the preparedness grant paid for that were key in mounting this response. One was it covered the salaries for our epidemiologists, and the other was some capacity in our state laboratory, which confirmed the source of the outbreak actually turned out to be in deer feces. Another example, during the H1N1 pandemic, we were able to have our state laboratory test samples for the flu virus without sending them to Atlanta. And that was very important in terms of a timely response, letting people know whether or not they were infected, letting providers know whether or not their patients had been infected. Access to lab services like this ensures that our local capacity and resiliency, especially during nationwide emergencies when the federal government facilities can get quite overwhelmed, it's really important that we have those capabilities at the local level. Another example from H1N1, and this had to do with our work together with the healthcare system to ensure that people had the care that they need. We worked with our local hospitals so that we could monitor what beds were available during the pandemic and respond appropriately. This really ensures that the whole healthcare system is ready to respond. And I'm very concerned that additional reductions are going to mean fewer trainings, less opportunity to exercise and drill with our local community and healthcare partners. And finally, one other example. You know, we have a very high rate of volunteerism here in Oregon, and I think that's true in many places across the country. But having a whole large group of volunteers arrive on the scene of an emergency can actually be a problem unless those volunteers are matched up with where the need is. So we have created a medical reserve corps. We have 15 units that have been organized around the state. We have over 1,000 volunteers, and this is going to be really key in mounting a response to a serious emergency that might occur. And this, again, is paid for with these federal dollars. So I've given you some examples of how this affects our everyday work. And, you know, we already in 2011 had our preparedness funding decline by about 11%. In terms of staff on the ground here, that meant that out of our about 60 people for the entire state of Oregon, we had to let about 9 of those positions go. This is a loss of expertise at the state and local level. We have fewer epidemiologists on call to investigate disease clusters. It means that when the Japanese radiation event occurred, we didn't have the opportunity to really fully implement the lessons that we learned from our response there. And, of course, being on the West Coast, we're concerned about how prepared we're going to be for an earthquake. This is a very high likelihood event here. So if we have another 10 or 11% reduction, I think this is really going to have serious consequences for our ability to detect and respond to future public health events. It may mean that some of our local jurisdictions simply won't have the ability to prepare for and respond to an event. It may mean that we're going to eliminate funding that we have to train our staff, and that's really key to our capacity to do this work. Or eliminate our ability to coordinate statewide with the healthcare system in the event of an emergency, as I described for H1N1. One other point about the budget reductions, of course, although we depend for this program in particular, but also for many of our other programs on federal funding for public health, our state general fund appropriation for public health overall has also declined. And so together with these federal reductions, I think the public health system really is in danger of not being able to respond to a public health threat that we might be confronted with. So thank you. I'll stop with that. And, Jeff, I'll turn it back to you.
Thanks, Mel. And you know, I think that gave us a real on-the-ground reflection of how important the federal investment is in preparedness, how dependent state and local governments are on that investment, and what the impact of the current cuts and potential future cuts might mean. I'd like to wrap up with some high-level recommendations that are featured in the report. The report goes into more detail on each one, but let me review some of them as means for addressing the ongoing major gaps in emergency health preparedness. I will start with our programmatic recommendations, but close again with what's central to our preparedness, and that is resources. So TIFA recommends modernizing and coordinating the biosurveillance system using up-to-date health information technology to be able to receive, compile, and analyze data in a more rapid and accessible fashion. This can be accomplished with a more strategic use of existing funds. But our surveillance system has to really harness the investment that's being made throughout our healthcare system in electronic health records to really be able to get a much more rapid and much more focused sense of what is going on. PIFA also recommends that the United States place a higher priority on research and development of medical countermeasures, so the vaccines and medicines and technology we need to identify what is happening and then to prevent or treat the results of whether it's a pandemic flu, something out of nature, or a bioterrorist attack. To succeed, we need to innovate that system from initial investment through distribution and dispensing, and we have a series of specific recommendations related to that. We also recommend enhancing the hospital preparedness program to create coalitions among hospitals to share surge burdens within a region, with emphasis on developing creative strategies, intensive training, and providing additional funding, particularly in large urban centers. That's going to be a hard one to implement without increases in that program. As we speak, Congress is considering the Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Reauthorization Act, known as PAHPRA, which is designed to address some of the systemic gaps in the country's ability to respond to health disasters. It is passed with a voice vote in the House, and the bill was marked up by the Senate Health Committee last week. The bills address many of the concerns that we raise in this report to some degree, and demonstrate that a lot can be accomplished by being more strategic, focused, and efficient in how we think about preparedness. But for many programs, like the ones we highlighted in this report, this legislation caps spending at fiscal 11 levels. That's last year's levels that actually reflect significant cuts in the base of support for a lot of these programs. The recommendations we make and the goals that Congress is outlining in the PAHPRA legislation cannot be accomplished without restoring those cuts. Without sufficient resources, many provisions amount to empty gestures and unfunded mandates. Overall, the grants for state and local preparedness, as I've mentioned, have dropped by 38% from fiscal 5 to 2012. The new PAHPRA legislation would cap these funds at this level, which will inevitably lead to more cuts because we won't be able to even adjust for inflation. And if sequestration scenarios happen for fiscal 2013, which is in about 9 months, we'll face significant cuts to these funds again. For the fiscal 2012 budget, we also saw declines in funding to the Strategic National Stockpile, the Hospital Preparedness Program, and a flat line for the BARDA budget, which is the Advanced Research and Development arm of our preparedness efforts. We've also seen significant cuts to the Department of Homeland Security's budget, including a $1 billion cut for first responder grants and a $2.9 billion cut for FEMA. So in many key areas, we are either not providing the money now or we will soon be facing significant additional cuts. And the proposed caps on funding at 2011 in the PAHPRA legislation means drops year after year since funding will not keep up with inflation. 10 years ago, during the anthrax attacks, we saw firsthand what happens when we don't invest in public health preparedness. We were graphically reminded of this again during Hurricane Katrina. The country has made major strides toward being better prepared. Many of the fruits of this investment were evident during the H1N1 flu pandemic response. While we were still far from our goals, we were leaps and bounds beyond where we were in 2001. Sadly, the track we're on now with the budget cuts may mean history could tragically repeat itself. When the next disaster strikes, we may not be ready. With that, we will open up the call for questions, operator, and I'd also like to remind everyone that the report and state-by-state information and individual state news releases are available online at our website, healthyamericans.org. Operator?
Yes, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please do so by signaling star, then 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that is star 1 to ask your question. We will pause for just a moment. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, that is star 1. We'll take our first question from Lisa Shireen with SIDRAP News.
Hi, thanks for being available today to go over everything. I had two questions, one about this, what you found out with the states, and the other just kind of helping define a technical term. I'm wondering if there are certain areas of the country or regions that you see a worse problem. Was there a range of concerns that you had from state to state? Also, just I'm a bit unfamiliar with the term sequestration, and I'm wondering if you could just kind of review that for people who don't know the budget lingo very well.
Sure.
Thanks.
So we did not attempt this year to do a state-by-state comparison, which we have done in past years. We do believe that, you know, the threat is, in a sense, across the board in terms of the impact of these budget cuts. Obviously, some states have actually invested some of their own money in preparedness, and so that may give them a little bit of a leg up. But I think, you know, we have not in this report attempted to make that kind of a state-by-state or regional comparison. The answer to your sequestration question is, so as part of the budget agreement, Congress set up the super committee to try to find budget cuts that would arrive at the over $1 trillion worth of savings that they were mandated to find. They failed in that effort, and as a result, there will be automatic, unless something happens between now and October 1st of 2012, there will be automatic across the board cuts in both domestic discretionary and defense dollars spending. And the estimate is that for domestic discretionary programs like public health programs, if the full sequestration goes into effect, in other words, there aren't different cuts found or there aren't tax increases, it could be as much as 10%. I think we're ready for the next question, operator.
Wonderful. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, that is star one if you'd like to ask a question. We'll pause for just another moment. We'll move on to Jordan Combs with NPR.
Hello. Mr. Cohn, thanks for talking about some of the ways that Oregon has specifically been affected. When you said that after the Fukushima incident you didn't have a chance to implement the lessons you learned, could you expand on that a little more?
You know, every time we have a response to an emergency, we do what's called an after-action analysis and generate an after-action report. And we always learn things. I think we did quite a good job, thanks to the preparedness infrastructure we had, of getting information out to people. And, of course, since the health threat after that for folks here in Oregon was there wasn't really a serious health threat, you know, the primary job we had to do was to get that information out to the public. It was really a communications emergency for us more than anything else, although, you know, there was some laboratory testing that we did and some other analysis of the health risk that having our preparedness infrastructure really helped us respond in the most effective way. But when we do this after action report, there are always some things that we learn, and we want to be able to implement those, but of course it takes staff and time and sometimes other resources depending on the issue to do that. That, I think, is going to be made much more difficult for us if there are further erosions in our budget. Thank you.
Thank you.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, that is star one if you'd like to ask a question. And we'll move on to Ian Simpson with Reuters.
A question. Given the budget constraints, do you think it would be wiser, or do you think it would be possible to distribute the budget funds on a federal level to areas or geographical regions that would be more likely to face biological, bioterror, or medical emergencies, rather than have a blanket distribution nationwide?
Well, I think the problem with that, two things. One is, to some degree, some of the investment is focused on areas at higher risk, and that's what the city's readiness initiative, to some degree, initially reflected. But the truth of the matter is we're not just talking about preparedness for a bioterrorist attack. I'm not sure we know well enough, or at least I'm not privy enough to those security briefings to know which places are most at risk. Remember, we had a terrorist attack in Oklahoma City. So I don't think that we can specify that there are particular places that are more at risk to a bioterrorist attack. But preparedness is about more than a bioterrorist attack. It's also about natural disasters, and those certainly cut across the country. It also can mean something like a pandemic flu. And when you're talking about an infectious disease, we're only going to be as well prepared as the least prepared state, because, you know, if a state has a reduction in their funding and another state does not, we're not going to be able to tell those diseases to stay only in that better prepared state. It doesn't work that way. So the kind of preparedness we're talking about is essentially all hazards preparedness. And to prepare for a natural disaster, to prepare for an infectious disease outbreak, or to prepare for a terrorist attack really requires a similar level of capacity across the country.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Jeff, if I might add
to
that, you know, here in Oregon, prior to 2001, the only real bioterrorist attack in recent memory was a salmonella outbreak that was engineered by the followers of the Bhagwan Shri Rajneesh in a very small town near the Dalles in Oregon here. This was in 1984. I don't think anybody could ever have imagined that this was going to be the site of a bioterrorist incident. So I think that just illustrates the point that Jeff is making, that this is impossible to really predict with certainty. But, of course, there are some things that we do know, some places that are at increased risk. We do need to have some funding targeted there, but it would be a mistake to only fund those areas.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
We'll move on to our next question from Charles Taylor with National Association of Counties.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Cohn, for giving some examples from Oregon that pertain to counties. As we know, counties most often are the level of government that implements a lot of these state programs. So I was wondering if you had any other examples of how some large urban counties might be impacted, counties like Miami-Dade County in Florida or Cook County, Chicago.
Those counties are not in Oregon, it's a little bit hard for me to respond. I can tell you that we've done an enormous amount of work in the Portland area. About 40% of Oregon's population lives in the metro area here. Not all of those folks are in Multnomah County, which is the kind of central county for Portland, but in the metro area counties, it's about 40% of the state's population. So obviously there's a lot of people potentially at risk in some sort of disaster, and we've done a great deal of work there really across the whole spectrum of preparedness, including training and planning, fixing up our laboratory capacity, working on our communications abilities, doing exercises and trying to really think about the unthinkable, which is a lot of what preparedness is really about. And we work at the state level very, very closely with our county partners. We are part of the same system, and we depend on each other to get the job done. So I think in the large counties around the country, I imagine they're going to be in the same place that Portland will be, that Multnomah County would be, and the other metro area counties here in Oregon, which is to say that these reductions really could have a very powerful impact on their ability to respond.
And let me add two things to this. One would be that if you look at page 61 of the report, there's a commentary from Alonzo Plow, who is the Director for Emergency Preparedness and Response for L.A. County's Department of Public Health, and he talks about the value of the city's readiness initiative in creating much broader collaboration among federal, state, and local agencies. And one of the comments he makes is that if the city's readiness initiative funding were reduced, the ability to create this level of coordination would be dramatically affected. And again, if we face sequestration in fiscal 13, that would be one of the programs that would be at risk. Similarly, the National Association of County and City Health Officials put out a press release this morning which talks about it in a different way, and this is in terms of responding to just a major disease outbreak. And as the report mentions, we've lost about 50,000 staff across the country in state and local health departments. And the example that NATRO gives is of Bay County, of the Bay County Health Department in Bay City, Michigan, where the workforce is now 20% smaller than it was during the H1N1 crisis and 40% smaller than it was just 6 years ago. And so that means, according to that county health director, that if there's another flu outbreak, it may not be possible to serve people in the way they did in H1N1. And it's that kind, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it's that kind of loss of core capacity that can only be restored by, you know, reliable federal funding. You can't make up for that loss of capacity with one-time money in the middle of an emergency. You can't have pop-up health officials who are trained, experienced, have the relationships and the capacity that we need.
Thank you for those two references.
And as a final reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, that is star one on your telephone keypad. And it looks like we have no further questions at this time.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Dr. Cohn for joining me this morning and thank all of you for having been on the call. And again, the report is available at healthyamericans.org along with state-by-state information. And if you have any additional questions, feel free to contact us. Thank you all very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation. Have a great day.